This is episode 14 of the RJM Classic Motorcycles podcast. We were going to kick off with a bit of listener feedback, but as this is going to be another special guest episode, we'll save that for next time. Although, we have had quite a busy morning, haven't we, Ray?
Yes, we have, and an example of somebody who's obviously listened to and watched our podcasts and is actually doing the right thing in terms of doing all the research he needs to, talking to all the right people, joining the BSA Owners Club before going and buying his machine.
Splendid. And we also had a visit from star of episode 6 and I think 9, dear friend Jeremy,
yeah, bless his heart. And his Thunderbird is still looking superb, sounding superb. And as we've all agreed, these things, if you get the miles in, just get sweeter and sweeter.
It was funny because I'd re-listened to his episode in preparation for today's special guest episode. So without further ado, let's meet Bill. Bill, how are you? How was your ride over?
I'm excellent, thank you. And it's a delight, an honour and a privilege to be here with you today. The ride was, as always, excellent.
Bless your heart.
Splendid. Now, who the hell is this gentleman, people may be wondering? And I think the best way to start that off is to talk about the position of authority you hold within the BSA Owners Club. So tell us about that, Bill.
I've never heard it described as a position of authority. I resign every year and I'm forced to stay on. Currently, I'm Public Relations Officer, BSA Owners Club, which sounds grand, but it means I'm the mug who does all the advertising.
How much of a poison chalice is it really?
It isn't actually, because I've got all the software. I like playing with stuff, and it helps me to pretend to be a graphic artist on design. But I have to say that my initial adverts, whatever years ago, I used to be National Secretary, and I covered for the PRO and then handed over the much more daunting task of National Secretary to Phil Bull in Birmingham. He still tries to stab me in the back every time he sees me in revenge. He's tripped me up. He's done everything. But the PRO, BSA Owners Club, established a style, which is an advert with a background photograph with minimum text on it. And that was designed by Rowena Hoseason from Real Classics.
Ah, yes.
As a freebie, because she thought my adverts were so abysmal. And so I've just developed that and kitted myself up with software. And we advertise exclusively with Morton's Motorcycle Media because they give us a very good deal. They're very supportive, and their production people are brilliant at translating my ideas and photographs into reality. It's an enjoyable job. It doesn't take that long. It's great fun, and members actually contribute photographs to me. I take blurry photos, so my photos are no good. I've trademarked the term blurry photo. And members do high-definition photographs, which I then cut and trim and use in the adverts. And people always comment. I did, a couple of years ago, have a series of complaints from other motorcycle clubs and traders. And they used to phone me up and say, why do you have pictures in your adverts and we don't? And so I couldn't really answer that. And then they said, why do our adverts have more words in than yours? Again, I couldn't answer it. And then I gradually started to advise people from other clubs and said, this is how you do it. And now there are a number of traders who actually use the same style of adverts and get an implied association to the club.
Yeah.
By having a style of adverts.
Yeah.
And in fact, there is one business who I personally endorse. I don't endorse many businesses, but there's one business I do endorse that does restorations. They've been brilliant for some work for me. And in fact, they actually asked me to produce a picture-based advert at some point in time.
Yeah.
And in case anybody doesn't recognise them, it's RJM Classics.
Thank you very much.
Yeah, I mean, we were delighted to have my Touring A65 when it was first produced, used in connection with the Owners Club advertising.
Absolutely.
And then when you put together an ad, which then went into the BSA Owners Club magazine for a couple of years. Again, minimal wordage. In fact, there was nothing there at all except our logo.
Yep.
Yep. So, yes, no, it's an interesting style and one that clearly works.
Yeah, so again, thanks to Rowena.
Yeah. Yes, yes, indeed.
So moving on, presumably to end up in the position you're in, you must have a bit of a passing interest in motorcycles. how did that come about in the first place? How did you get into motorcycles? And I suppose talk about how you got into spannering as well.
Yeah, I blame the parents. My dad used to have a BSA 250, and my mum and he used to go out on a Sunday for a ride. And then one day he sold it, and I remember I was very small, my mum in floods of tears, because he'd sold the BSA.
Right.
He then turned up with a Plunger Golden Flash with a double adult chair, and all was well again.
Yes.
And my big brother was 13 years old than me. He's dead now, but he used to come with us in those days. He was doing an apprenticeship as a French polisher, but he'd still like coming out on the bike. And there were five of us in the sidecar.
Jesus.
And my mum on the back of the bike. And she used to, I always remember her wearing blue trousers. And she used to sleep on the back of the bike.
Yeah. Wow.
And we used to have a little transistor radio in the chair. And coming home on a Sunday night, it was Sing Something Simple on the radio.
I remember it well.
And then as soon as it got dark enough, we'd have Radio Luxembourg on.
Ah, yes.
K-E-Y-N-S-A-J-M. Horace Batchelor.
Oh, goodness.
So that was it. And then my dad had a garage a few streets away from where we lived in Liverpool. And he used to keep the bike in there. And I used to go round. I was a tiny little toddler, sat on the tank holding the handlebars, convinced I was riding it, driving it.
Yeah.
And, you know, you get arrested nowadays. But,
you would.
It was great. And that started me off. And then when I was about five or six, my dad could never solder and he could never do ignition timing.
Right.
He knew how to do both, but he couldn't do them.
Yeah.
And so he taught me to time a magneto. And so I used to do the ignition timing for him. And he also taught me what happens when you get your 5 or 6 year old son holding a spark plug lead and his dad mischievously kicks the bike over.
Oh, dear. Oops. It'd lock you up for it now, wouldn't it?
Yeah, absolutely. And then when I was able to, I was strong enough and old enough, probably about age 11, he got his mechanic mate to teach me to solder with a red hot poker. And then for my 13th birthday, he bought me one of these newfangled things, an electric soldering iron, and a big bobbin of solder. And right up to the point my dad died just before his 99th birthday, I've kept the bobbin with a little bit of solder on it.
Oh, bless your heart.
And I kept telling him, "You silly old buggy, I can't use it, you know, it's just so much."
No, I understand that.
And so that was good life. But he always had spanners. He always did stuff. He'd lived in, his father was an engineer. He'd lived in South America and Central America till he was 18. And he was used to fixing things.
Yes, yes.
And he spent his time, once he was called up during the war, in the Royal Engineers. Mm. He'd gone into the Royal Engineers because he tried for 3 days to go through the small arms training.
Right.
And the first time they saw one of his bullets hit the grass bank behind the targets, they declared him fit for passage. And the training sergeant told him, "Don't even think about infantry. You're going in the Royal Engineers. Mm. You can do more harm." And so I just grew up with spanners, and having a brother 13 years older than me, it was just natural. We all grew up spannering.
And the attitude from your father didn't change at all when it actually came your turn to start riding, because I think that's, you possibly get that from some parents, that it's all fun and games until actually, "Mum, Dad, can I do the RAC, ACU, whatever the bloody scheme was, and get on some wheels myself?"
Well, those things cost money. And you had to be a certain age and you had to have license and everything. So my big brother had an F model Victor.
Ah, F model Victor, yeah.
The engine died And with his mate, he bought another one with a dissolved body and a good engine, a rebuilt engine. And so I was enlisted to help because I'd been working in a garage doing bodywork from when I was 14 on a Saturday and school holidays. So I was enlisted to help. And we took the front panel off, the bonnet off the new old car, the dissolved one, rested it on the front bumper, and then towed the engine out of my brother's car onto the bonnet and scooted it away. And then it was a question of brute strength and ignorance to get the new engine in. Now, as that progressed, my brother had an NSU Quickly two-speed. I'm hearing music in the background.
I think that's an aero engine, actually.
Is it?
Yes, I think so.
Yeah, I don't know if the mics are picking it up, but there we go.
Okay. And
I thought you were just pausing so we could all laugh at someone owning an NSU Quickly.
No, it was a superb bike. The two-speed one looked like a big push bike.
Yeah.
And I was 13, I think. And so I nicked it and rode up the street on it, frightened myself to death because it was a back pedal rear brake.
Yeah. Mm.
But I loved it. So I did a bit more riding on it. And then Roy, my brother, went up Marcus and got the three-speed one that looked more like a motorbike.
Yeah.
And so I used to ride that regularly. And then because I'd been spannering for years, friends... older guys who had bikes, all sorts of bikes, used to ask me to help them sort them out.
Yeah.
And so everybody just helped. And so I had to test ride bikes. Mm-hmm. So I was riding everything.
Mm.
Now, in those days, it was before Merseyside existed. It was Liverpool City Police.
Right.
And they couldn't stop us riding. So they taught us to ride properly.
Right.
And Liverpool City Police used... Triumph Thunderbirds, Speed Twins, and they were low geared, and they were flat out sort of whisker over 70, but very quick there. Mm. And they used to brag that they could out accelerate anything around the city, and nick them, and they could. And there was a cafe we used to go to called Dutch Eddie's, just a coffee bar place, and we used to go from there round Penny Lane bus terminus riding. Against the jukebox.
Yes.
That's what you did.
Yeah.
And
did that really happen? I've heard tales of that.
Oh, no. Sure. It happened all the time.
Yeah,
And the other thing to bear in mind, there was no rivalry between scooters and motorcycles. You used to swap. And if you were working on something, somebody would lend someone a scooter, rider. If I was working on somebody's Lambretta or Vespa, somebody would lend them a motorbike.
Okay, that's interesting because there definitely was in... the area where I live, there definitely was an antagonism between the two. You say not in Liverpool?
No.
Wow, okay.
None at all.
That's an interesting piece of history.
And people used to swap. And anyway, we used to do this cafe run. The cafe was called Dutch Eddie's. It was actually called the Windmill Cafe. And the fella and his wife who ran it, he was called Eddie. So naturally it became Dutch Eddie's. He wasn't Dutch. But his name was Eddie. But the policeman who looked after us there, I use that term loosely, and encouraged us to ride properly, was a sergeant. And I can't remember his other name, but he was Nigel something. And he was very, very good. And he commanded respect because on his police speed twin with the valve radio and all the other rubbish, he was faster than any of us. And so he commanded total respect.
Absolutely.
So what he told us, we did. And it was interesting because about 4 years ago at Stafford Show, the retired police motorcyclist club were there, and there was a chap whose accent I recognised. And he'd been out and traced and bought his Saint back. And we were just talking about it, and it turned out that the sergeant who trained him when he joined the Busies was the same Nigel who'd actually taught me to ride. And he actually reinforced everything that I'd said about this fellow being brilliant with us, such a good instructor. And this guy who I met at Stafford, he said he was the same with all of them. He was absolutely strict, but very helpful and supportive. Now, some people got the impression I was a bit cocky. I don't know where from. And I was in the sixth form, mm-hmm. and I had a license by then, but I hadn't taken my test. And I was doing something on Queen's Drive, which you shouldn't do, in that I was riding a little bit too fast. And so I was instructed to turn up at the skid pan that the police used in Liverpool mm-hmm. on the Friday night after sixth form. I turned up. It was raining. I thought they'd just give me a bit of a rollicking and mm-hmm. then send me off home. They didn't. They had beaten up old ex-military M20s mm-hmm. with ball tyres, and they said I had to ride around the circuits. And you just rode around in an oval and then rode around in a figure of eight in both directions. Mm. So did that and thought, yeah, fine, so what? You know, this, it's a bit of an inconvenience, but nothing too much. And then the instructor set a time, and there was myself, three other lads and a girl who were all in for this disciplinary session.
Right.
And so we had to match the time of the instructor. Well, two of the lads dropped out. The third one did it. The girl did it easily. And I did it. And they said, right, that's it. And then the instructor said, no, these three are too cocky. So they sprayed the skid pan with water, just like a fireman's hose. They used, just wet it. And we had to do the whole thing again. So, of course, the first thing that happened was I was made to go first. And the first turn I made, I went base over apex. Yeah. And the bike went one way and I went the other way. Didn't even follow the bike. We went in completely different directions, which was a learning experience. Anyway, got back on and did it again after about three attempts falling off. Managed to do it. Got near his time. And they said, well, that's near enough. Sent the girl up. She just did it first time, didn't fall off. Right. And then the other fella did it, and he had a couple of goes, about twice as many as me. So then they said, right, have you learned your lessons? And of course I said, no, what lesson am I supposed to have learned? You haven't told me what I'm supposed to be learning. I'd have paid attention if you'd told me that. So they then sprayed it with the emulsion, the oil and water mix.
Oh, God.
Oh, my goodness.
And he set another time. And, of course, I was made to go first. I was base over apex again. Mm. Except this time, I high-sided.
Right.
Wow. And because the front wheel hit the grid where everything was draining back for recycling, the front wheel dug in, and I went over the top. So that was interesting. Mm. And so got back on, and it matched his time. And then the girl matched his time, first time out. And so we did the other rounds, and I began to think, she's not a bad rider. She's actually quite nice looking. I wonder what she's doing tomorrow night. So, anyway, she said no. But that's life.
It is.
And, you know, you've got to be philosophical about this. This was a Friday night. I wasn't going out with her on the Thursday night. I wasn't going out with her on the Friday night. And I still wasn't going out with her on the Saturday night. So nothing had changed. So life carried on. Anyway, we carried on the session. They said, that's it. So the other lad went home. And I said, no, I want to match the instructor's time properly. And they said, well, we all want to go home. And I said, no, you've invited me here. So I made them stay. Anyway, I did it and whipped round. And it was a great learning experience.
Yeah.
So I learned a lot about handling a bike on that one evening. And then I got home with my sixth form uniform covered in oily water and everything. And my mum said, oh, that's a bit of a mess. Where have you been? So I told her. And she said, well, you best get stripped off and wash it all before your dad comes home. So instead of going out Friday night, I was washing my uniform. But, yeah, my parents were very in favour of riding. coming back to his original question.
Yeah, no, absolutely.
My dad loved it.
You found your way back very well. Very commendable.
Yeah. And my mum just loved it. She used to say, be careful.
Yeah.
But she never drove or rode. I suspect that before she met my dad, she did ride. She never drove a car, but I suspect she rode bikes. Because she was well up on it.
Yeah.
And I remember the little lessons she taught me that have stood me in good stead because I ride all year round.
Yeah.
And that was always keep the base of your spine and the top of your spine warm because they're the two points where nerves are concentrated.
Yes.
Wow. And if they get cold, you get hypothermia very quickly.
Wow.
And
that's a good takeaway for the listeners there, if nothing else.
The other thing she used to say, because somebody gave me, do you remember the vinyl plastic coated cotton over trousers?
Oh, yes.
Horrible things.
Yeah, I had a jacket like that.
And
they
used to split and crack and you used to get wet anyway. Yeah. She used to tell me not to bother with them because once you're wet, you're wet and you can't get any wetter. But I think that was because she was Irish. So once you're wet, you're wet. And as long as you're warm, that's it.
Yeah.
Well, glad to move on from that.
How many hours have we got? You'll be editing.
We can always do a series. Now, you, like Ray, are an A65 man. I think that's fair to say. How?
I'm an accidental A65 person.
Go on.
When I went to college, 1969, I took my test, and it was interesting. I bought a Bantam. Because I was going to college, and bought a one-year-old D14-4 just to give me something reliable to ride. And my test came up, and I was clocking up a lot of miles on it, and I was having some work done. I wore it out, and I took my test got the bike in the July, and then in the December, I think it was, I was allocated a test. And I'd already worn it out. I'd clocked up a lot of miles, and I was getting a rebore on it, and big end. And I know that was afterwards. On my first test, I took my test. And after about 43 minutes, the examiner came running out and waved at me because I was in Widnes then and I was riding around the block in Widnes, round and round and round, getting dizzy. And the examiner came running out and waved at me to stop and said, "You failed."
What?
Which surprised me, seeing as I'd been riding since I was 13.
Ooh.
And he then exited the scene and a car... A learner instructor, and another one came running out to me and said, "Come inside. There's a group of us want to talk to you."
Mm-hmm.
So I went inside the test centre, and they said, "We're all prepared to give our names to you. Your guy wasn't watching you. He was inside talking to his mate, and then he said, 'Oh, something.
Mm-hmm.
I've got somebody doing a test. I'll have to get out. He'll be out of time.' And he ran out and just gave me a fail." So me being me, I complained. I was already in the RAC for my bike insurance, and I complained to the Liverpool Echo and the RAC. Mm. And the RAC took it up, and my appeal was rejected on the grounds that the only grounds for appeal was the test wasn't conducted in accordance with the basic regulations, which it was. Mm. It was an authorised examiner as an authorised test centre. But... in the meantime, the test had gone up to 10 shillings, I think. And they gave me, or £10, I can't remember which it was.
No, I can't.
It was money. Anyway, they gave me a free retest. And that's when I wore the bike house, the week before my test. And I got this cancellation through. And I didn't have a bike to do the test on. So my dad said that a fellow he knew... who he didn't like, he'd been in the army with, he didn't like, but he had a Honda 50 step through. And so my dad had a word with him, and this guy offered me the Honda, but he used it for work. So the only time I could collect it was an hour before my test.
Right.
And I'd never ridden one. So, and I don't know if you've ever ridden one of these things. They are horrendous. They are not like any other motorcycle you've ever ridden.
No, especially not the gear change.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And I turned up and my dad said to me, look, he said, they'll be watching you closely because it's a special test.
Mm.
So don't wear your leathers. Go in a smart pair of trousers and a tweed jacket and your helmet and just your gloves and wear shoes. So anyway, I did, and I turned up, and the fellow, the senior examiner, looked at me, and he was a bit shocked because he was expecting some gobby leather-clad scouse kids. And so anyway, my dad's advice
was
good.
You tick one or two of those boxes, surely.
Yes, yes. Thank you. And so anyway, I went out doing the test, and when I got on the bike, the first thing that happened was I did a wheelie on it because it wouldn't go. And then this pedal that is a gear change. And, of course, it engaged with the engine revving. And the first thing I did was popped a wheelie.
Right. And also, if you wanted to pop a wheelie with one of those deliberately, you would engage gear, you would open the throttle, then release the gear lever, and then the clutch bit, and you were away.
Yeah. And I found all this out in the course of an hour.
Yeah.
So I went doing my test. And I was, shall we say, moderate in my use of the controls because this thing frightened me to death. And I was running round, and then he said, just go round the block again and I'll do your emergency stop. And as I rode away from the test centre, the centre of witness in those days had a big area with a massive wide pavement outside a hall that was a venue used for music gigs and whatever. And as I approached this big roundabout and was spotting everything, a young woman with a pushchair suddenly darted from the building right across the pavement and shoved the pushchair out right in front of me. Well, of course, I like to refer to it as a controlled stop.
Was it?
It was a total panic. I just hit and stamped on everything. And this bike did a stoppie, and the back end swung round and ended up parallel with the pushchair. And I looked at the woman and said, oh, golly gosh, that was a near thing. And she burst into tears and apologised. And the examiner came running up, and he said to her, are you all right? Is your child all right? And she said, yeah, he didn't touch us. He missed us. It was my fault. I didn't know how it happened. And she was really distraught. And he said, no, it's okay. If there was no accident, that's fine. And then he said to me, I think I'll count that as your emergency stop. He said, you're not going to do that in front of me. He said, because you might miss next time. So I got my little pink slip. And that was late 1969. And then I used the Bantam, and then there used to be a motorbike shop in Widnes in Albert Road, and the guy who ran that was a really nice fella, and he had an A10. It was a 61 Golden Flash that had no chrome on it. The tank from original was black and cream.
Right.
And there were some done like that without chrome.
Right.
And
this was presumably during the chrome shortage.
It was afterwards. It was a 61, yeah. So the tank may have been made in the 50s.
Ah, okay, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. Typical BSA, make them with what you've got.
Yeah.
And it had a broken gearbox because the A10s, if you ran them without oil in the gearbox, the main bearing used to seize and rip itself out the gearbox casing. And obviously a design fault. So I bought this bike off him for, I think, 15 quid, and then went and borrowed my brother's Mini and trailer and took it back to where I was living then when I was at college in Northwich. And I was in Wirral 100 Motorbike Club, and we used to race at Alton Park. And so I had access to gearboxes, and I got just the outer case of someone. So I sorted this bike out. And then Canterbury the sidecar manufacturers went bust. Mm. And I bought a brand new Canterbury sidecar chassis, still with the brown paper wrapping on. Mm. And thought that would be fun to attach that to my A10. Yeah. And so I put that on and rode that with no counterbalance weights on it or anything, just a bare chassis.
Mm. All right. Yeah.
And that made interesting cornering. It was good fun. Even took it round Alton Park once until the course marshal accused me of being totally mad and a danger to myself and any low-flying aircraft. So that I had two bikes then. And so the A10 was my real love of bikes. I then sold the Bantam to Sports Motorcycles in Manchester. By then, it was on its third stage of tune. I used to write lengthy letters to George Todd, because he was still around building Bantams in those days.
Indeed.
And George used to send me instructions and drawings on how to tune it.
Wow.
And I carried a BSA leaflet describing the D44 as having a top speed of 64 miles an hour. And I got stopped once on the road between Alvanley and Weaverham in Cheshire. It was a little back lane. The police used to sit up on the hill with good sight and had markers on the alongside the road spaced exactly 2 miles apart.
Mm.
And they timed me between these markers at 68 miles an hour. So they decided that obviously must have been dangerous and exceeding the speed.
Mm.
I was delighted because the best I'd ever done with a stopwatch was worked out 64, which was the supposed top speed. So yeah. Anyway, they didn't prosecute me because this is before CPS days when the police used to prosecute.
Yes.
They didn't prosecute me because I had this leaflet from BSA that said it was 64 miles an hour. Now, the only difference to see on this bike was I had the handlebars on back to front and upside down, as you had to do.
Mm-hmm.
And there was nothing else apart from central plug, which was a George Todd modification.
Oh.
And so I got off at it. And then I got stopped again on the Northwich bypass, flat out, and paced by a police car in the days when they used the corrected speed on the second man, before any electronic interventions.
Yeah.
And they had me for 83 miles an hour.
Jesus.
So, of course, I just laughed and got off with it again. And then I took it up to Sports. I'd resprayed it. First of all, because it was originally black, I did it with the metallic red the Triumph Tina scooters were done in.
Yes.
And then I did it again in a colour, metallic, pale metallic blue, Vauxhall Aquastar Mist.
Ah, yes.
You'll remember that colour, right?
I do, yes.
From your history.
Aquastar Mist, Sebring Star Mist, Starfire Star Mist. Yeah, I remember all of those.
Yeah, you see? And anyway, I took it up to Sports Motorcycles for them to buy it off me. And they said, well, why would we want to buy it? And I said, well, take it out and try it. So Steve Wynn, who then was the owner of Sports Motorcycles, who was a guy who later sponsored Mike Hailwood's return to the island.
Right. Wow.
Steve Wynn just, he humoured me and told his mechanic to take it out. And the mechanic came back with a grin, as broad as you could imagine. He said, if you don't buy it, Steve, I will. So the Bantam that cost me £130, I got £113 for it back.
Right.
4 years later.
Not bad.
Having worn it out completely twice and rebuilt it and tuned it. So that was it. So that I kept the A10, but then I bought an MG Midges. And my then girlfriend wouldn't ride on a bike, so she just had to make do with the Midges.
Yeah.
And I kept it, and then eventually, after moving all around the country to escape the authorities, I ended up in Somerset, and another job enforced move up to the northeast. And I was moving into a house, the garage wasn't built yet, it was middle of winter. My wife wasn't keen on putting the motorbike in the living room. And so I sold it in Somerset, and that was 1979. 1997, I got permission to buy another bike.
Ah.
I was working away from home a lot, and I used to strike up relationships with bike dealers. And when I was working away, I used to borrow bikes and leave the car and go and do my work on the bike and borrowed. I learned an intense dislike of BMW airheads at this time. I just could not get on with riding them. I don't like them, and I still don't. Other people love them, but I just found them boring. And
well, I always liken them to, and I'm going to get hate mail for this, liken them to being as exciting as white goods.
Yes. Yes. I'm going to use that one. Thank you. I've made a note of it.
Listeners, also help yourself, I'm sure.
So I got permission, and I started looking for another 61A10. It had to be a 61A10. Then in April 1981, I got a transfer, internal transfer job, back down to central London. And I bought a house in September that year in Luton, as being the nearest I could afford to live to London. And in the time in between the April and September when I bought the house, I was virtually living at Scratchwood Services on the M1. And so to escape things, I used to go and look around. I was looking for houses. And then I found this place in Alsey where I found a bike place. And there were two fellas working there.
And I should point out at this stage that I wasn't one of them.
Yeah. No. One of them seemed a lot more my sort of guy than the other. And so I just had to mention I was looking for an A10. And the one who was not my sort of person just said some dismissive things about it. So I just thought, fine, I won't bother. And the other one, whose name I realized was Ray Messinger, started to give me some guidance and tips and ideas. So I carried on looking. And then Valentine's Day, 1998... just before then, we'd found an advert in a paper for an A65 Thunderbolt project in Brierley Hill in Birmingham. So we went up there, and this was Valentine's Day, so my wife bought it for me.
Wow.
I paid £1,000 for it. It was all there, all complete, all running, but not properly assembled.
Yeah.
And the guy wanted the money because he had an A70. And he had some other bikes, and this was the best one to sell. So I went back on the Saturday with my trailer, camping trailer, with a slot cut in the back end to allow the slot in the front for the front wheel to go onto the A-frame and a slot in the back to allow the back wheel to stick out of it. And so we dragged it home, got it running. Ray helped me with various bits, and then other work things came into play, and then another house moved to Hitch, and the bike just sort of hung around. Then I was still looking for an A10 all this time. It had to be a 61 A10. Couldn't find one that was what I wanted and affordable. I could find plenty of them, but
yes,
they weren't what I wanted or they weren't affordable. Then I'd moved to Hitchin, and in September 2000, somebody advertised in the local rag in Hitchin an A65 of unknown model for £1,000 as a project. So I went round to look at it, and the bike ran. It was clearly a bitzer, and
they all are.
It ran, but it had this unbelievable knock in the bottom end. And the chap who was selling it also knew Ray.
Oh.
And he said he thought it knocked its crank out, time inside bush.
Yeah.
So I thought, fine, I'll buy it. He very kindly delivered it on a trailer on the following Wednesday night. And I thought to myself, I'd been working in London, I'd come home, I was tired. And I thought, why have I done this? So I shoved it in the back of my garage. And on the Saturday morning, I was doing some work for a client, and he phoned me up, and he was abusive to me and hostile. So I advised him to cease and desist and go away and procreate elsewhere, and thought, I'm not doing this work till Monday now. And I thought, I'll go and have a look at that bike. I wheeled it out and found the bottom end knock was because the restorer who I'd bought it off, it changed hands a couple of times, and he bought it back in, hadn't tightened the clutch centre nut. So the clutch was rattling around on the main shaft. So a little bit of spannering, and that was okay. A couple of new cables made up. And a few other bits and pieces on this, I did. And by lunchtime, it was up, running and ready. But then it's the heavens opened. So I phoned another of my friends who runs Del Basso Motorcycles in Hitchin, and a former BSA dealer.
Yes.
And they used to have a shop that ran between two streets.
Yeah.
And now it's only in one street. So I'd phoned him up and said, can you MOT it for me next week? And I won't mimic the Italian accent because he's a big scooter man. He said,
we've been trying not to mimic your accent, I'm afraid, Bill.
You can't do it. You can't say Chechen. And so my kids used to love that story, Chechen Lechen. But so he said, no, I'm not doing it next week. You bring it along now. And I said, but it's lashing down. And he said, it's only 10 minutes. So he made me take the bike round, got an MOT on it. And then I used it for work and ran it into London, ran it everywhere. And it was a great bike. It's an A65P, ex-Birmingham police bike, which I told everybody is totally original in that everything on it was originally on something else. And so I even took it to a show in one of the villages beyond Stevenage on a Saturday. And as a joke in the BSA Owners Club, I'd made a little sign for it, which I'd had laminated by a printer in Hitchin. And I described it as 1964 BSA 65P. P stands for prototype. This was the original twin-cylinder single engine that was used to develop the central cylinder for the BSA Rocket 3. And so I took this along, went to this little posh village show where they had all the MGs and Lamborghinis and Maseratis on show and Vincents and whatever. And I stuck my tatty old bitter BSA in with paint that was so thick on the tank, it was flaking off in lumps. And put my little sign on it. Well, I'd looked around these cars that were really nice, and about 4 o'clock I went home. Thought no more about it. Monday night, there was a knock on the front door, and my son answered it and came to see me and said, there's a posh man here who wants to see you. So I went to have a look, and there was this chap with a military blazer with a regimental badge on, nice dress shirt and a bow tie and this moustache, very straightforward. And he said, Miss Nelson, is it? And I said, yes, sis, can I help you? And he said, may I come in? So I said, yes, of course, come in. Would you like a coffee? Yes, it's not in a mug, is it? So I said, I'm sorry, I don't have any cups. I only have mugs. Oh, well, in that case, thank you, no. I said, would you like a scotch? Yes, do you have a Glenmorangie? And I said, no, I've got Glenfiddich. Oh, no, that's a beginner's malt. No, thank you, no. Anyway, the point of the visit is, dear chap, on Saturday you turned up at the village show. And I said, yes. And he said, and you left early. And I said, yes. He said, well, I have to tell you, he said, you've won the prize for the most interesting vehicle in the show. I said, how come? And he said, you had a sign with it. So my son went out in the garage and brought the sign back. Yeah. He said, yes, that's it. And my son let me down. He burst out laughing. And he said, and young man, what's so amusing? And he said, Dad, tell him. So I told him. It was a joke in the BSA Owners Club. This guy stood up, stuck his elbows out, and had his fist clenched in front of his
hips. And he said, "This is an utter disgrace. I formally, on behalf of the committee, now herewith withdraw your award of the prize, take back the certificate and the trophy, and tell you that you, with immediate effect, are banned from ever appearing again at our shows or our club," and stormed off into his Range Rover and drove off at great speed.
Oh, bless.
I applaud you on your command of the accent there, Bill. I wasn't aware you could do that. I was going to say, see, if only you tried, you can do it. But I think I've taken the piss enough already.
Well listen, man, you don't give me no aggravation. I'm the boy who grew up in Taxdebt, so, you know, you don't mess with me. Well, until I was 16, I was known as Bill Da Honky. And then when I'm 16, I'm grown up, so I became Mr. Bill.
Well, on the subject of taking the mickey, I should point out that the first time we met, Bill, you set the precedent. Because Ray wanted to show you something outside, and you went, "Here, come and have a look at this." And you turned to me all glum-faced, went, "Well, what did you say?"
Shall I say what he said? He has to put a cup of tea in me and stop me nicking stuff.
No, that came at a later date. What he said at the time was, you were leading him outside. He said, "I have to go with him. He doesn't trust me. It's because I'm a Scouser."
Oh, was that when I was pretending to come from Birmingham?
So we've heard Bill's side of the story from how you two met, but Ray, talk about from your perspective, why don't you?
Well, I was aware of Bill as a visitor once or twice before I then got to know him well enough. But obviously, when you first came through my door, for me, you were just another client, just another visitor. Whereas for you, it might stick in the memory a bit because it was the first time you'd been to us. So what were your impressions?
Well, I hate to say it, but my impressions were all good. I happen to be a bit fastidious. I grew up with spanners and working very, very clean on engines and doing stuff properly. That was the way my dad taught me.
Yeah,
and I came in here. I'm very cautious who works on my cars and who works on my bikes, anything that I don't do myself. And I came in here, and one of the things I spotted was a properly organized workshop, properly organized job sheets, and all customers' stuff. We've all seen it when people send stuff to platers or send stuff off for machining, bits get lost.
Yes.
And what I spotted first about Ray's place was everything was ordered. It was very tightly cramped. It was small premises.
Now, this presumably was, because I was going to ask this, this presumably was when we were in 2A.
81.
Got to bring the small unit over the other side.
Yeah, it probably was. Yeah, next door to the fellow with the paint.
Yes.
Yeah. And then he moved it all over here to this unit. It was still cramped. But everything was ordered. There were job sheets with every job, all the times recorded on it, and all the parts used, all the notes on the job. So Ray could tell each of his clients exactly where their bike was up to.
Yeah.
And he also encouraged people not to come in during the week, because that was working time, to come in on Saturday morning. Mm. And which was sensible, because then he wasn't wasting all his working week doing stuff. But the other thing that struck me as I got to know him more, and as because of my work times and whatever, I noticed he was spending best parts of an hour at each end of the day moving bikes in and moving bikes out.
Yeah.
But he still did a huge amount of work. Now, later on, I had a lot bottom end when my A65P eventually threw all its oil over the back tyre. I thought it's just a collapsed oil line. Ray advised me to take it apart, presumably because he knew the restorer who'd built it previously. So I took it apart, and what I found inside the cases meant I should have got new cases, but I didn't. I gave it to Ray, and he fixed the bottom end for me. It was way beyond what I could do, certainly in the little shed I had at the time.
And interestingly enough, yours was, that motor was the first of those that we discovered the anomaly where there are slight differences in the actual crankshaft between early A65s and late A65s. Yeah. and that where you get a later crankshaft in a very early set of cases, you then have to machine the thrust down on the timing side bush because the crank won't fit in the cases. Now, when Bill first brought that to us, that was an anomaly we hadn't experienced. But we've now done about four. And
one of which just a month or so ago.
Exactly that. Came across the same anomaly and were able to confirm finally that that's what the problem is. So if you get an A65 where there appears not to be enough room in the crankcases for the crankshaft, it's early cases, later crankshaft, and that's the explanation.
Yeah.
Sorry to interrupt.
No. That is a technical solution. The restorer who'd built the bike had attacked the cases and the time inside bush with a power file, and it was not pretty. Anyway, all credit to Ray. He did an excellent job on that. But my impression was it was a well-ordered place, it was well-organized, and the records were there, so everything was verifiable. So that's carried on to this day.
Thank you. The other thing...
Checks in the post, by the way.
the other thing which... I thank you for that, but the other thing I'll also thank you for, and you talked about cramped space, and most people will know now that we occupy double the size of premises that we used to back then. Say early on, we had half of Unit 2A in Ram Yard, and then we moved across to Unit 3 here, which was bigger, but we still filled it up pretty quickly. But were subsequently able to buy the freehold of both Units 3 and 4, which we now occupy. And Bill, in his daily life, is a business consultant and was able to organise a friendly bank manager who was prepared to offer me a remortgage on domestic property for the purpose of buying commercial property, and that takes some doing. And thank you for that, Bill.
That's very kind of you, Ray.
It was all your doing that happened. So the fact that we occupy these two units now and have done for the last 15, 16 years, I've nearly paid the mortgage off, by the way, now, is in no small part with your help.
Oh, I'll send him a bill for commission. We never did that. But the interesting thing is, what Ray glosses over is the adjoining unit was occupied by various scallywags. And when there were two young lads in there bringing in cars without number plates and removing parts from
the Robbie's Auto.
I was about to say, mentioning no names. Look what you've done.
Oh, it was fun. But the other thing Ray doesn't mention is that when he did buy the freehold of the units, he enlisted me. He provided the ladders, I provided the chainsaw, and went up around the back and chainsawed down the overgrown conifers in the next door garden, which is a care home, isn't it, or something?
Yes, it is.
Yeah. So I had to go up a ladder because these things
made
a noise.
I've never heard this.
Well, if you go and look, there's trees outside the side.
Yeah.
And I did those.
Oh, no, there was.
And then at the back, I went up the ladder and chainsawed the tops off the trees.
There you go.
Things I do for my clients.
Not afraid to get stuck in. Nobody can say that.
But yeah, all the impression of the place was favourable, and it's never changed. I do constantly recommend RGM for that reason.
Yes, we're very grateful.
There's one other anecdote I'd like to cue you up for that you told me when you first arrived here today, which is back on the subject of you challenging authority, which I'll worry paints you in a slightly negative light, so I'll apologise for that. But before that, and we look at wrapping up, Ray, is there anything further you want to ask Bill now that you've got the opportunity?
No,
for posterity.
Other than the fact to make the statement that our relationship has been characterised over the years with much mutual piss taking
and much tea drinking as well.
It's mandatory, both.
Yes. Do you think one fuels the other? I don't know.
It's probably likely.
So, Bill, what were you telling me just when you arrived here this morning when you were once looking into doing the whole blood bikes thing?
Yes. A few years ago, I was asked, could I can tribute put something back because I'd been seriously ill and rescued by the NHS. And I was asked, would I consider doing blood bikes? Because one of the I give the NHS two requirements. One was survival. The second was to get me back on two wheels. Mm. They achieved both. And I was asked, would I help out with blood bikes? So I said yes. So I looked into it. And unfortunately, they'd made it a mandatory condition that you had to do advanced riding qualification. Mm. Well, having been taught in the first place by the police and having been stopped by the police on three separate occasions when I was in a different area because I was riding like a copper and they wanted to see who this person was whose bike they didn't recognise, and having done a couple of police assessed rides, I was reasonably confident I was okay. And I thought, well, okay, I'll do one of the approved advanced courses. I won't say which one. And I made contact, and the guy who was the observer was younger than me. He was mid-40s, and he was a bit full of it. And it turned out, when I questioned him, because that's what I do, I interrogated him, he was... he'd had a license to ride bikes for 2 years. He'd done direct access, and he'd done direct access through a one-week intensive training course. And so we went out for a little ride just to go and get coffee and see what was what. And I thought, this guy's a dork. I don't like riding in groups anyway. Mm. I ride on my own. I do FTFW, which is follow the front wheel, and wander off and... By definition, you can never be lost and you can never be late, because if you go in somewhere indeterminate by an indeterminate route, you can never be lost or late.
Exactly.
That's FTFW. Anyway, this chap, he was riding like a duck. Anyway, he wanted to do a pre-ride and he was doing something. So I went over to meet up with him and I had my CB500 then, which is another story. The rare BSA prototype CB500 with Honda badges on. And we went out and we did about 50 miles. He was following me and he used a technique with a microphone in his helmet connected to a digital recorder to observe me. And when we got to a place where we were having lunch, he ripped into me about my riding style.
Right.
And criticised me. I'd ridden through a village, and this village had an S bend through it. And in fact, where I live now actually has one of these same bends. And he criticised me on the right bend entry with an immediate left, slight uphill, for being hard over to the centre line and not hard over on the left for entry. And I pointed out to him that because of the immediate left-hand bend after the right-hand bend, if I'd gone hard over left, I'd be invisible to any approaching traffic.
Yeah.
And so I'd positioned accordingly. And then just after a short straight, there was another bend, and I'd positioned there to get maximum sight round the bend, which he criticised my positioning. And I pointed out that it was a bus route and there were a couple of side roads joining it, so I positioned myself to be as visible as I could. He'd criticised my approach and going through a roundabout, which could have been quite quick. There was good line of sight on the road coming from the right, reasonable but not brilliant line of sight on the road joining from the left. And I'd slowed down to about 25 miles an hour and went through and then gunned it on the straight. And he criticised that and I said, well, fine. Yes, there was good line of sight, but I slowed down because of the diesel on the road.
Mm.
He said, what diesel? I said, didn't you smell it? And he said, I've got no sense of smell. And I said, well, the early warning of diesel is a smell. I said, so if you've got no sense of smell, you need to be extra careful because you've just bowled through a roundabout.
Mm.
And there were a couple of other things on the route he did. And he criticised, and me being... I come from a village called Arrogance, which is 5 miles south of a place called Serious Cockiness. And so I said to him on the way back, I said, well, we go a different route. I'll just follow the front wheel. You follow me. I'll lead. And he said, no, 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 no. He said, I'll lead. I'll show you how it should be done. And I'll choose the route. So I said, yeah, okay, fine.
I'm just hoping at this point this bloke falls on his arse, by the way.
Not quite.
No, okay.
He went off and he was riding briskly. And he had a Hinkley Triumph and one of the old 900 Daytonas.
Yep.
Yeah. And he was riding and he was quick. He was far quicker than me in a straight line. And then he was virtually stopping to go round bends and all the rest of it. And I found this irritating and annoying. So we were approaching a set of swoopies for a good bit of bend swinging, good line of sight across the hedges. And so I just hung back. And I thought, he's bound to hit the brakes, as he always does, and tiptoe his way through. So I hung back and waited for his brake lights to come on, and then I gunned it.
Yes.
And went round the outside of him and disappeared. And I rode off. And I did, again, it was irresponsible. I just wound it up to 10,000 revs through the box. Mm. And the CB500, I admit now, for anybody in the authorities who's listening, it would not do 120 miles an hour. It would only do an indicated 119 and a half. Anyway, down the road, there was a lay-by, and I pulled in, put the bike on its stand, took my jacket off, took my helmet off, took my gloves off, and waited.
Mm.
And the guy pulled in, and he had to go at me. And I said, no, I said, you're the ace rider. I am not doing your observed test.
Yeah.
And then just recently, a Founders Day, I met somebody from Leicester Blood Bikes who's got a Sprint GT like mine.
Mm.
And we were talking, and he said, you really ought to do it. So I'm considering this again.
Right.
But we've got our former chairman of BSA Owners Club, Trevor Collier, is in the IIM and actually organises things. And so he can organise the observer for me.
Ah, right.
Mm. So we'll probably
have another go.
Have another go.
Good for you.
Just to close off, we didn't.
Oh, must we?
Well, we can do another episode.
We must.
We must.
We didn't discuss this beforehand, but is there anywhere people can get in touch with you on social media or whatever? Or do you want to remain anonymous? I understand you're quite prolific on one or two forums, or is that all top secret?
Yeah, it's not top secret. Real Classic Facebook forum is restricted to subscribers to the magazine only. Mm. So I recommend everybody subscribe to Real Classic.
Absolutely.
It was an innovative magazine introduced in 2002 by Frank Westworth and Rowena Hoseason. And it was totally outrageous. They'd already had a website. Mm-hmm. They introduced the magazine. And it's not the same old articles regurgitated. There are proper lengthy articles. And they are written by the readers themselves, so it's always on theme. And they pull them together. They also publish some articles online. And so Real Classic is one. If you want to see me there, you have to do it. The BSA Owners Club has its own forum, which you don't have to be a member to access. Mm. That's on bsaownersclub.co.uk. So we make that open to anybody who's interested in BSAs. So anybody who has an interest in BSAs can go on there. There are countless other BSA forums that people can go on.
Yeah.
I don't use many because I'm still working and I don't have a lot of time. But then the other one is ikba.co.uk. That's in the process of change because Martin Gelder, who organized that, sadly died at the beginning of July, tragically. Very quickly, very ill, and we're looking at maintaining that. Now, ikba.co.uk was something Martin adopted from me because of one of the phrases I use. When you give advice to somebody with old bikes, it's not like looking stuff up in a manual for a modern bike and saying, you know, plug in the diagnostics and this is what it is. You can give advice based on experience and it's ish advice.
Mm-hmm.
And you require somebody to have the gumption to actually take it in that form. Mm-hmm. So 90% of ignition problems are caused by the carburetor and fuel, and 90% of fuel problems are caused by ignition problems. And you only find out when you try.
Mm-hmm.
So IKBA was the term I gave, and we created with another friend who died a full academic series of qualifications, the IKBA qualifications. And we've got certificates, degrees, postgraduates. The only qualification we don't have is a PhD, because it's very difficult to find somebody to supervise PhD students in IKBA, because IKBA stands for I know bugger all. And so by definition, it's difficult to do research in I know bugger all. So, people can find me in various places. BSA Owners Club is the best place. And just join the club and join in the fun. Interestingly, going full circle to the adverts, since we've been running the adverts through Morton's Media, who are very good to us, the membership has gone up. And for 4 years in succession, our membership has increased.
Wow.
And not bad when you consider the last BSA was built in 1973.
Yes, absolutely.
And an increasing number of those BSAs that are in the club have been built or worked on by Ray.
The other, just a final point is that, and obviously Bill is a club officer, and I often hear people coming into the shop complaining about they've contacted this owner's club or that owner's club, and they've not had a reply, etc., etc. And I have to point out to them, in the defence of these people, that they, like the rest of us, have to work for a living. Invariably, their office in the club has taken over what little remains of the rest of their lives. So if you don't get an instant reply, it's because they're busy living.
Yeah. The other thing is that people often query about the club rules. We have a rules manual, which is updated as and when necessary. It's there. Every new member gets a copy of it. And when you see our members' meetings and AGMs and other things, the one thing that you're not allowed to do is refer to the rule book, because all we're interested in is BSAs on the road. Just this week, somebody has queried that nobody seems to tour anymore on classic bikes. We've got a club of 3,500 people. A great many of them tour on it. Mm. We have internationals. Next year, the BSA Owners Club International is back in the UK. This year, in November, it's in Australia. Mm. Last year, it was in Holland. Mm. People actually do a lot of miles on their bikes. Yeah. Because, as Ray said very early on, the more you use them, the better they get.
Bill, thank you very much for joining us. It's been a real privilege. I only hope our laughter wasn't too bloody distracting. And we also had one or two technical difficulties, which I just contributed to there, which that'll teach me for trying to do the bloody music on my phone instead of putting it in afterwards. Anyway, you can subscribe to us on iTunes or YouTube, give us a like or a comment or whatever, and you can email us rjmpodcast@gmail.com, or you can check out our website rjmclassic.com. Thank you very much for listening, and we'll see you again.